This is the time set for oral argument on the case Ibarra v. State, case number 62107. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you may reserve time for rebuttal since you filed a reply brief. How much time would you like to reserve?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, my name is Therese Shanks. I'm here today on behalf of Appellant David Ibarra. We're here today to ask this Court to reverse and remand the District Court's order dismissing Mr. Ibarra's complaint for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. This appeal raises two core issues that we seek this Court's decision on. The specific main issue is, what does NRS 41.0322 subsection 1 require an inmate to do to comply with the administrative remedy exhaustion requirements when filing a prison grievance and following that grievance throughout the prison administrative grievance system? There are two main issues that are raised by that statute. And first, that is, what does subsection 1 of NRS 41.0322 require an inmate to specifically state in their grievance in order to be considered to have exhausted any eventual legal claim that they bring before a district court? The second issue is, what exceptions are there to subsection 1, such as in a case as this one where administrative remedies are no longer effectively available through all levels of the grievance process? If this Court has an order that you would like me to address those issues in, I'd be more than happy to. The District Court dismissed Mr. Ibarra's 5 claims for relief for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. 4 of those claims were dismissed because the District Court found that Mr. Ibarra did not specifically state in his grievance the legal claims that he was then asserting in District Court. NRS 41.0322 does not really include any language that would give these inmates guidance. And we don't have any guidance in the Nevada jurisprudence that gives inmates guidance as to what they need to specifically state in their grievances in order to be considered to have exhausted eventual legal claims that they bring. However, the United States Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit have addressed this issue rather extensively under the PLRA, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which is NRS 41.0322 sister statute. So in Jones versus Block, the United States Supreme Court stated that all that a prisoner needs to do to exhaust their administrative remedies, all that they need to state is facts or arguments that comply with the prison's internal guidelines. That decision left open the question of, what do you do when the prison isn't very clear, when their guidelines aren't very clear, and the prisoner isn't given that level of specificity, which the Ninth Circuit then addressed in Griffin versus Arpaio and Actar versus Mesa, and they stated, in such a case, when the prison guidelines are not factually specific as to what legal statements need to be made or what facts need to be asserted, all that you have to do is comply with notice pleading. You just have to let the prison know what the facts are that you are claiming give rise to your harm, and that should be sufficient to put the prison on notice of the harm that you're claiming, and that should be sufficient for them to later defend against legal claims. Those holdings are consistent with Nevada's notice pleading standard. And it is our position that those holdings should be adopted by this court to state that when a prison is not specific in what an inmate needs to plead in order to satisfy the administrative remedies exhaustion requirement, all they have to do is comply with notice pleading. Give the prison sufficient facts of what it is that you're saying hurt you or harmed you, so the prison then is prepared to either remedy it or to defend against it in a later legal claim in district court. In this case, the Nevada Department of Corrections doesn't give inmates that guidance. The administrative regulations that were in the record before this court that Mr. Ibarra relied upon simply stated, give us your facts and your documents. It never said, you have to let us know what your claims are. It never said you have to name the people you're going to name in a complaint. There's no guidance, really, aside from the facts. So Mr. Ibarra filed a grievance stating, I disagree that you found me guilty on the disciplinary charge, MJ-29. I don't believe there was evidence supporting your finding that I was accepting fees for legal services. The state argued below that while that may have supported his third claim for relief in his complaint, it didn't support his first claim for relief, which challenged the filing of the disciplinary charge itself. It didn't support his second claim for relief, which challenged the upholding of the disciplinary charge. It didn't satisfy the fourth claim for relief, which was basically challenging the refusal to have appeal on the second level, which prevented him from accessing district court. And it didn't satisfy his fifth claim for relief, in which he stated he was retaliated against as a result of that charge. But that's not what the notice pleading requirements require. He doesn't have to state his legal terminology. In fact, the Ninth Circuit has very succinctly stated that such a requirement would be ludicrous because the point of the prison grievance system is not to lay the groundwork for litigation, and it's not to have these inmates put their legal claims before the prison. It's to remedy factual issues. And so here, Mr. Ibarra stated he didn't agree with his disciplinary charge. So clearly, he's not going to agree with the person who filed it. He's not going to agree with anyone who upheld it. He's not going to agree with the fact that he didn't get to appeal it throughout the grievance system. And he's definitely not going to agree with the fact that he lost his job in the prison because of it. So it is our position that Mr. Ibarra's complaint sufficiently put both the prison and the district court on notice of what it is exactly that he was grieving. And under the Ninth Circuit precedent, which we urge this court to adopt, that is sufficient to exhaust administrative remedies for those four claims.
And in fact, a prison official told him that he didn't need to do anything further, correct?
Correct, which brings us to the second issue, which is what are the exceptions to administrative remedies exhaustion? In this case, Mr. Ibarra was informed by a warden, by an associate warden, that he had exhausted the administrative remedy process. He got a letter saying, you've exhausted the grievance process, no further relief is forthcoming. In other words, you're done. We're not going to deal with this anymore. And this is another issue that Nevada has not addressed, and that, again, the Ninth Circuit has addressed in quite some detail. The Ninth Circuit holds that when this occurs, administrative remedies are effectively unavailable, and there's no point in asking an inmate to continue to appeal through a futile administrative exhaustion process. They can bring their claims in district court. Now, Nevada hasn't addressed it in this context of prison litigation, but we do have substantial jurisprudence under our administrative exhaustion case law that states there's no point in requiring anybody to exhaust an administrative remedy if such exhaustion would be futile. And
why wouldn't that be adequate, the law that we have as far as the administrative process? Why wouldn't that be adequate in and of itself, and why would we have to look to the Ninth Circuit as far as futility is concerned in exhausting administrative remedies?
Our position is that it is adequate, but unfortunately, so many of these prison grievances do not have lawyers who have access to that civil jurisprudence. It's prisoners. They're representing themselves. They look only to prior prison litigation cases, and so it would give a lot of guidance, not only to the inmates, but to the prison officials themselves. As the Ninth Circuit pointed out, explicitly recognizing this exception actually furthered the purposes behind administrative remedies, exhaustions in the prison system, because it encourages prison officials to make sure they are thoroughly and adequately addressing prison grievances. And it helps reduce the amount of claims that then come through just out of sheer frustration, just from inmates filing cases in district court because they just feel like they're not being heard. And a lot of times that's all they want. They just want to be heard. So while we do have our administrative exhaustion civil jurisprudence, it would be beneficial to interpret NRS 41.0322 because that's the statute that these inmates look at, and that's the statute that the prisons rely on, and they don't necessarily expand their research beyond that.
How much discussion was there in the district court about the evidentiary sufficiency of the charge? In other words, the state is arguing essentially on appeal that there was either some or substantial evidence to support the outcome, and therefore whether or not exhaustion should apply is immaterial, since he pleaded guilty to a 34, MJ-34 charge. That was the end of him as a prison law clerk, and therefore we shouldn't even take this very seriously because that eclipsed his MJ-29 charge. Do you follow the question?
Yes. There was no discussion of the MJ-29 charge. What the district court held was it dismissed the first, second, and fourth and fifth claims for relief for failure to specifically plead them in the grievance. Then it dismissed the third claim for relief, which dealt directly with the MJ-29 charge because he'd never appealed it to that second level. Then it looked at the fourth claim for relief and interpreted that as trying to assert a liberty interest in a prison and disciplinary appeals process and dismissed it on that grounds. And then the fifth claim for relief it interpreted as trying to assert a liberty interest in a prison employment and dismissed it on that grounds. So there was no discussion of the actual evidence supporting the MJ-29 charge. Where that argument has come from is a little bit of a misinterpretation of Ibarra's argument in his opening brief regarding his fourth claim for relief. If you read Ibarra's fourth claim for relief and you read it liberally and construe it under the pro se litigant pleading standards that this court has adopted, that the Ninth Circuit has also similarly adopted, it doesn't appear that he's necessarily stating, I have a right to a prison appeal. He's arguing, basically, you've impeded my right of access to the court because you wouldn't hear my appeal, and now I can't exhaust, and so I have to go to district court, and I'm in this catch-22. And he's also arguing, by refusing to hear my appeal that I can't exhaust and I can't argue in district court, my disciplinary charge is being upheld. And I don't agree with that because I don't think there is evidence to support it, and I'm allowed to bring a procedural due process claim under the 4th and 14th Amendments, under the sub-evidence rule. That's a claim he's allowed to assert. So the point that was made in Ibarra's opening brief was that he's allowed to assert that type of due process claim. It was not to argue what evidence did or did not support the MJ-29 charge. And he never had an opportunity to argue on his behalf regarding the evidence supporting that charge, and the district court never received any evidence from either side as to what exactly was before the prison disciplinary board.
Which we don't know at this point. I mean, there may be a transcript or a tape recording of the hearing, et cetera.
Yes, it appears it was recorded. So.
Thank you.
I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if you have
any
further questions.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Clark Leslie. It's my privilege and honor to represent the respondents in this case, the State of Nevada, and the Nevada Department of Corrections, and various administrators and employees of the department. Before I begin, allow me to extend my gratitude, and I'm sure that of the Court, in Ms. Shanks and her firm offering and providing pro bono services in this case. And I don't just say this gratuitously. There are times, certainly not before this court, but where I've experienced a pleading or a case where an inmate has been very unclear and a judge has to guess what's going on, and sometimes the inner lawyer kicks in subconsciously and the judge ends up making great arguments for the inmate when they're not there. I don't have to worry about that here, and so thank you, Ms. Shanks. We appreciate your efforts. I do want to talk about three basic things. I want to talk certainly about the grievance process and exhaustion. I do also want to address what Justice Pickering mentioned about the extent to which the district court considered evidence that was before it in the court below. And I also want to talk about what I think is the overriding matter in this case, and that's the question of whether or not Mr. Ibarra, in the end, received due process. And these are very important considerations. One of the things that I have waited for, and after some 10 or 11 minutes of comment, I'm still waiting, and after 8 instances where Mr. Ibarra has had an opportunity to explain the evidence which he was caught red-handed in possession of, we are still waiting some comment on why the decision was wrong. Now, conclusionary comments about there was insufficient evidence or how could they possibly have found me guilty, that doesn't meet the burden. Now, we all know that we're dealing with the sum evidence standard that's set forth in the Superintendent of Corrections, Walpole versus
Hill. Well, but wasn't the motion in the district court premised and ruled on the basis of failure to exhaust administrative remedies?
It is, Your Honor. And what the state says is that, and I'll go ahead and discuss the 5 causes of action and the order of the district court. But we say also that it is very difficult for us to comprehend how it is possible to simply ignore this record of guilt. So, yes.
We don't have the whole record, right? I mean, that's part of the challenge with this case, is we have a complaint to which was appended, as I understand it, the warden's or the prison official's letter saying, you don't need to keep going, we're not changing our mind. And then you have an answer to which, or a motion to dismiss, to which was appended an affidavit saying that letter saying you'd exhausted was mistaken, you really do need to exhaust and it hasn't occurred. That's the record, right?
Well, Respectfully, I would disagree,
okay.
Justice Pickering.
Now, tell me what is in the record then.
The notice of charges, which were issued and presented under Wolf versus McDonald, contain a wealth of information and evidence that Mr. Ibarra had, he has had 8 opportunities to challenge and comment on. The preliminary hearing, the disciplinary hearing, the disciplinary appeal, the informal grievance that he filed, 3 first-level grievances after that, and then his complaint, not to mention the appellate brief.
Well, let me stop you there, because I guess I have a misunderstanding. My understanding was that he did his first informal grievance, followed by a first-level grievance, and then was sent the letter by the associate warden indicating, knock it off, we don't want to hear any more about it. And my understanding is he had a grievance, the prison has a grievance process that is more complex than that.
You are correct.
And if what you're saying is he had 8 opportunities, why do you even need a grievance process at all?
Well, the grievance process very specifically requires that every inmate include all the facts, all the witnesses, and all the individuals that can support the core argument made in the appellate process or in the grievance process. Mr. Ibarra on 8 occasions has ignored that obligation.
I'm talking strictly about the grievance process.
So am I.
Okay.
Then let's talk about the informal grievance and the 3 first-level grievances he filed. All he stated in there was there was insufficient evidence provided to support a MJ-29 that I accepted legal fees on behalf of doing work for an inmate.
So are you telling me that he had the opportunity to go through each and every step of the grievance process?
No.
Okay, where was he stopped and how many levels did he have left?
He had 1 level left, and I agree with what Justice Pickering and what you are mentioning, that Associate Warden Walsh at NNCC did write a memorandum in April, I believe, of 2011 that said, okay, you've exhausted the administrative process.
But so, he didn't actually have that opportunity, and then for the state to come back and move to dismiss based upon the fact that he hadn't exhausted seems a little disingenuous to me.
Well, not as to causes of action 1, 2, 4, and 5, because the...
Well, that's a notice issue.
Yeah, right. And the grievance, which obviously this court has read, we interpret as being strictly limited to the one issue about the receipt of legal fees for providing legal services.
That's claim number 3 and the...
Primary claim.
Yeah, right. The MJ-29.
Right. And we would argue that, you know, cause of action number 1 for the intentional filing of a false claim, cause of action number 2 for not dismissing at the preliminary hearing, cause of action number 4 for failing to hear the disciplinary appeal, which is something different, and then finally a claim for retaliation in cause of action number 5. Those are distinct, discrete, separate issues that had to be addressed by individual appeals. But let me get back to the 3rd cause of action and what was and was not allowed. There was a 2nd level of grievances that he was required to fulfill, but in this instance, I agree with my esteemed opponent that when that process has been frustrated through one means or another, and in this case, the memorandum would lead a reasonable inmate to conclude that he or she has fulfilled the appellate process, he did, in fact, have the right to then pursue his claim. As to your statement, Justice Perigari, that it's then disingenuous for the state to argue strictly on the basis of exhaustion or a motion to dismiss on this record, the district court took a different position. And it took the position that on the basis of this record and on the basis of all of the prior opportunities that Mr. Ibarra had to comment on the evidence and so forth, it was reasonable to conclude that a motion for dismissal was appropriate.
Counsel, I have to stop you there, and I'm sorry, I hope I don't...
No, that's all right.
...skew your train of thought. You keep referring to the evidence that Mr. Ibarra was supposed to put before any level, frankly, in order to avoid the motion to dismiss. As to Claim 3, I'm only talking about Count 3.
Actually, to fulfill his obligations under the exhaustion process.
Okay. But accept that as true, and his claim is insufficient evidence, what is someone supposed to show as evidence of insufficiency if you haven't gone through the process?
All right. First of all, he had gone through the informal and three first-level grievances, and he hadn't provided an iota of contrary argument or exonerating.
How do we know that, though? Isn't there a recording of the hearing that was not provided in the district court record in this case?
Your Honor, you're correct that there is a recording. As a matter of fact, it is mandated by AR 740. Right. All disciplinary hearings must be recorded.
Is that part of the court record?
It is not, and we would argue that in view of the fact that the Penthouse magazine was unquestionably contraband, as were the 21 pills, as was the W-2 form, it was incumbent upon Mr. Ibarra to take the time to obtain that record to, at some point, present and meet his obligations under the grievance procedures, which require the inmate to present all facts, evidence, and witnesses in support of his claim.
I'm sorry, I got to go back. I get the magazine, the pills, the W-2. I don't see the providing legal services claim. I mean, I think he acknowledged the magazine, the pills, I don't know about the W-2, but he acknowledged all of that. So...
An inmate is in possession of a W-2 form, and he's caught with a note that says usual price.
Well, that could be for a number of things. Usual price in a prison setting, come on.
But in conjunction with possession of two items of contraband and a W-2 form that isn't his, it is not a stretch, certainly not under the some evidence standard of Hill, that it would be reasonable and appropriate and not a violation of due law for a disciplinary hearing officer to conclude that there was some evidence to support the claim.
Wouldn't that make it even more important to finish the grievance process as outlined?
There was no evidence, and I know where you're going, and at some point I have to and I will acknowledge that there was one step that he had coming to him that he didn't take. But I flip that over and say, after 8 opportunities to do so, or at least 4 in the grievance process, what would he have said at the second level grievance that he hadn't already had an opportunity to state but didn't? And even more importantly, what kind of a rule of law is it where a charged defendant individual can continually and expressly ignore incriminating evidence and then obtain a benefit from it? I mean, if that's what we're going to walk away from in this case, then every criminal defense attorney in the country is going to be banging down my door. That is not what we want to say. This individual has never bothered to come forward with one single piece of exonerating evidence. And there's something wrong there when, after all of these opportunities, that hasn't been taken.
Well, let me just pause you there, because the problem I'm having with this is probably more procedural than substantive. He's in district court on a complaint. You file a motion to dismiss that he didn't exhaust. I don't have the record before the referee. We have a transcript or a tape recording that's never been transcribed, but I don't have that. You move to dismiss on exhaustion. It's ruled on the basis of exhaustion. We're now on appeal, and you're saying I should infer from what must have been in the record, which was the pills, the note, the penthouse, yeah, that he was somehow bartering legal services for the things he had that he shouldn't have had.
And that,
but for me, if that wasn't raised in the district court and we'd never got to see what was the record in this admittedly truncated grievance procedure, I feel like I'm ahead of myself and ahead of the program, and that it really wasn't fair to this defendant, and we're going to compound that unfairness. It's a bit inarticulate, but I'm trying to... It's tough.
I know where you're coming from, and I appreciate your frustration. Another DAG prepared the motion, but that's neither here nor there. This case should be sustained, and the decision in the district court should be upheld because it is black-letter law. And let's remember, this is a de novo review of the record. The law provides and allows for us to uphold any decision that is supported by the record below.
So long as it has gone through all the appropriate steps.
Well, in this case, there was an appropriate step taken. There was a notice of charges that was served in conjunction with Wolf versus McDonald. It advised the inmate, Mr. Ibarra, of all of the evidence, all of the facts, all of the witnesses, and all of the charges against him. And that exists in the record, and that's at numerous places in the record.
But my point is, and we're running out of time, and I think it's Justice Sadas as well. If you had moved on the basis that, as an evidentiary matter, he's dead to rights because there was some evidence to sustain the MJ-29 or whatever it is, he could have come back and said, no, there wasn't, and presented the transcript or whatever it was that we don't have. And then we would have had a fully developed record and a decision on that basis. So for me, the problem I'm having is allowing that argument without it having been aired in the district court, when the record could have been developed in the district court, and why we shouldn't just remand and say, look, administrative remedy exhaustion isn't right. I have no idea about the rest of this because we don't have a complete record and he never had the opportunity to address these points.
And you're right, and I can't wave a magic wand and change that. All I can say is that there is a substantial, unchallenged record in this case of unquestionable contraband and evidence that would support an argument that would allow this court to uphold the dismissal, even though that wasn't the ground that the court ruled on, because a right decision ruled upon for the wrong reason, as this court knows, can still be supported and used to uphold a dismissal.
But can still be sent back for a remand?
Absolutely. It can absolutely be sent back for a remand, and that's the big option here. I ask and urge that this court not leave its common sense, and I know it won't, at the courthouse step.
Well, actually, that's leave your common sense at the courthouse step. You're not following procedure, not you personally. I didn't
right.
want to indicate that. But don't we have to address the fact that procedures aren't being followed in these kind of cases? And to you, it might be easy for us to say, okay, don't worry about it. We didn't follow the procedures, but you've got another basis to uphold this. I mean, it's disturbing to me.
Justice Perry, and also Justice Seda, I understand that.
And it isn't a matter of leaving your common sense at the courthouse steps.
Well, all right. If that comment disturbs the court, I retract it and I apologize. But what I do wish to mention, it is common for alternate reasons to be used to uphold a particular ruling. And I think
I don't have a problem with that in the context where it was fully developed and it isn't unfair in some way to the person who's meeting the new argument on the merits. Here, and I'm fixated on whatever happened at first hearing where there's a recording we don't have, that this litigant is disadvantaged by your raising this new argument and saying we really should resolve it on some evidence, no harm, no foul basis.
And the best response I can give to that, Justice Pickering, and it's really what I'm going to rely on, is this. This individual received a fair due process hearing. He knew that at some point he would have to address this evidence. And after numerous opportunities to do so, he still hasn't done so. And in that instance, whatever bad taste we may have in our mouths because there has been a lack of following of the procedures, and I'm a procedure guy as much as the next. I rely on it more than I have to fight it in representing my client. Nonetheless, the evidence is so clear. And the fact that he had so many opportunities to call witnesses and evidence and so forth, and he had access to the record the recording and could have presented it under many different circumstances. That overcomes whatever discomfort I think we may have about the failure to follow precisely the rule and the procedures as to grievances. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
You have 4 minutes remaining. We extended the time on your opponent, but the 4 minutes should be adequate. Could you add just 1 minute to Ms. Shanks's time in case she needs it? So you have 5 minutes at this point.
Thank you. I would just like to address a little housekeeping matter first. When the state is referring to the 8 different opportunities, just to be clear, what occurred is there was only the informal grievance and the first-level grievance, but the first-level grievance was rejected for administrative reasons. You didn't attach the right documents, and so we had to keep filing that. So that's when what he's talking about with the different grievances, and those are in the record. Then going to his argument about whether or not Mr. Barr received substantial due process, as this court astutely pointed out, we don't know if he would have gotten that transcript because he never got to go to that second appeals level, and we don't know what he would have presented as exonerating evidence. But as Justice Seda also pointed out, it's pretty rare that somebody who argues insufficient evidence then presents evidence of the insufficiency. Usually they just say, this is what the evidence is, and that's not enough. And that is the insufficient evidence argument. And what Mr. Ibarra did do, and what is in the record at page 75 on the record of appeal in the disciplinary charges, he did explain the contraband. He specifically stated, note about the news and the price was just something to do with the Penthouse magazine. The person is an Oasis that had me help with his tax form. I just had it in my pocket to give to him later. So his insufficiency of the evidence charges, look, you found me with a W-2 form, which has nothing to do with legal advice. Anybody can fill out a W-2 form. You found me with pills. You found me with a Penthouse magazine. He found me with a note about the usual price. The prison official said he wasn't even clear who the note was coming to or from. I wasn't at work. I wasn't in the law library. That is not enough to find that I was accepting fees for legal services. That's what my grievance is about. That's why there's insufficient evidence. And if you read the disciplinary charge itself, it states, the note found in the inmate indicated that the usual price and he was found taking medication from another inmate. Therefore, MJ-29 is an appropriate charge. But again, the note about the usual price and the medication are not related to anything legal related. And so it's unclear why Mr. Barr would come forward with any additional evidence in that case. And again, as this court pointed out, we don't know if he would have because he wasn't given
So you would ask us to reach the substantial evidence issue then? You would say we have all we're ever going to have on that?
No, I think that this court was correct in saying that he should be given that opportunity to let us know because, you know, I don't know what evidence he had. We don't have the transcript. He didn't have the transcript. He didn't go get the transcript because he was told he couldn't appeal to
I think Mr. Leslie's point is you have a W-2, you have pills, Penthouse, and this note that says the usual price. He's putting that string of evidence together and saying from this, a W-2, and I get that sometimes accountants deal with W-2s. It's not always legal advice, but that you're a prison law clerk, you have a W-2, you have a note that says the usual price, and you have 2 pieces of contraband, the Penthouse and the pills, the inference is you gave legal services to the person whose W-2 it is, and in exchange you received the pills and the contraband. At least that's a plausible construct, and that meets the sum evidence standard. I think that's his argument. I may be wrong, but if we meet you on the merits of that and that's all there is or all there ever could be, maybe there is some evidence. My concern is whether or not it's fair to make that judgment at this stage of the proceeding when the main point resolved was exhaustion.
That's our concern as well because he wasn't given that opportunity. He wasn't given an opportunity to go through the whole process. And the process is there to make these things more efficient. We don't know if Mr. Ibarra would have proceeded to district court at all. If he had gotten to the second level, maybe they would have reversed it. Maybe he would have just said fine.
So you would address this simply on exhaustion?
Simply on exhaustion.
And the fact of the futility of it, given the letter from the associate warden?
Yes, absolutely. Because, the prison grievance system is, it's what keeps the inmate litigation as confined as it can be. And when you take away that grievance exhaustion issue, it becomes we flood our courts with frivolous complaints. We flood our courts with frustrated inmates. We don't have a grievance system that's working properly. So the crux of it is that you need to make sure these inmates are given at least the grievance system. And when you when it's unavailable to them, it's not the system's not working.
You would reject a remand. You want us to make the outright decision that he was just simply denied based upon the exhaustion and the futility.
Well, I'm not sure how this court would not remand then, because if it was found that he had exhausted, or if the district court erred in failing to dismiss for failure to exhaust, it would necessarily need to go back down to be adjudicated on the merits.
Okay. I want to thank both counsel. You still have the actually.
I have nothing further.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and oral arguments. They were excellent, and I appreciate the advocacy. The case will be submitted and will be in recess.